substance abuse and crime among the juvenile populations?
Well, I think there's a well-acknowledged connection between the two. A significant percentage of young people in some urban areas, close to 60 to 70% of young people who are arrested are under the influence at the time that they're brought in. So clearly it's a contributor. As a mental health professional, I also think there are some things we need to understand about substance abuse and why youth choose to use substances, how that plays into emotional or behavioral problems that they may already have, and the interconnection of those things for juveniles who commit offenses. I think the public would be quite surprised, remarkably so, at the prevalence of mental health and substance abuse problems and the extent to which those co-occur in children in the juvenile justice system. It's quite significant.
That brings up the issue of resources then. How do you adequately assess the needs, the mental health needs, substance abuse needs of these kids? Are there resources in small towns, rural communities? Are there counselors to assess the needs of kids in those areas?
The resources is definitely a problem, particularly when it comes to assessing what's going on with a kid. Here's a kid, let's say, who's skipping school and also is smoking marijuana. And when the child comes to school, also has behavioral problems and tends to get in conflicts with teachers and peers. So to sort out what's really going on with a kid like that is difficult. What we do know is that about half the kids that have substance abuse problems do have mental health disorders as well. That's what the national data says. And depending upon the kind of disorder they have, if it's ADHD, for example, where a kid tends to act out their problems, as opposed to depression, where kids don't always act out depression, but perhaps turn those inward. It influences the type of drug they might use, the frequency, but there definitely is overlap and strong correlation between the two issues. And a good assessment is the key to getting at what's going on with the kid. One of the problems we have, particularly in this country, is the fact that a lot of mental health professionals are not trained in both mental health problems and substance abuse problems. They tend to get training in one or the other. So we'll pick up one of the problems in kids but miss the other one, which is a problem.
Is there a level of denial that these problems even exist in some communities? I've heard from counselors that, for instance, communities choose not to put more money into programs because they don't see the need for them, don't see that the problem exists.
Well, clearly there's a strong stigma that's still attached to mental health problems of any kind. And, you know, the national polls, again, say probably 50% of people believe that there is no such thing as mental illness, that people with major mental illnesses are could help themselves and be better if they only wanted to and that sort of thing. When you lay on top of that drug and alcohol use, and particularly when we're talking about substances that are still illegal, you're talking then about you know, some additional stigma and additional tendency to want to not talk about those problems and those issues. So it tends to be when a child violates the law or comes in contact with law enforcement that we tend a lot of times for the first time to look seriously at what's going on with the child. And again, it's unfortunate. You know, we ought to have in our communities better access to early intervention services, to services that help us identify these problems in kids before they come in contact with the law. I mean, nothing is more tragic than waiting till a child has violated the law to attend to a mental health or a substance abuse problem.
Do you think attitudes toward mental health issues are different in rural areas?
It's an interesting question. I've heard kind of two different things about rural areas and mental health. One is that rural communities maybe are even more protective or more supportive than an urban community might be. The flip side that I've also heard is that there's a good reason to hide the fact that you may have an alcohol or drug or mental health problem in a rural community, because everyone knows everyone else, and you don't want your neighbor knowing that you're getting your prescription filled for antidepressants. You don't want your employer who lives down the street from you to know that you drink, and that sort of thing. So there's sort of the smallness and the fact that people know each other sort of cuts both ways, I think, in a lot of rural areas. Probably the biggest problem for rural areas is just the lack of professionals and the lack of access to good treatment and good care. I know a lot of the models that we've developed for mental health treatment and substance abuse treatment have been developed in urban areas, and then we try and import them to rural areas, and it doesn't really work very well. So there are problems with access, particularly for children, to good child psychiatrists, to preventive care. Rural children tend to be poorer. They tend to be more apt to be uninsured than urban children. So managed care plays out differently in rural areas than it does in urban areas. So all of those sort of present obstacles, I think, for rural areas.
In terms of treatment models, then, are we working on developing models that would be more suited for rural areas? How far are we from having some treatment models that perhaps would work better in rural areas?
I think we are. I think we're tinkering with models that have been developed in urban areas to make them work in rural areas. I mean, again, not all rural areas are alike either. They're not a kind of a homogeneous population either. So we know, for example, that rural areas that have high Native American populations need certain kinds of interventions, that that what we do with families and kids needs to be culturally appropriate for those kids, and that sort of thing. So I would say we're not as far along as we need to be with how to address problems in rural areas or with certain populations, but we're certainly working on it.
How often do you think substance abuse among teenagers, for example, is self-medication for a mental illness that may be undiagnosed?
I think that's a really good question, and it's one that we're starting to look at. There's some a kind of a large study that was done. They call it the National Comorbidity Study. Comorbidity is just a fancy word for co-occurring substance abuse mental health problems, or where you have both problems at the same time. And it showed about 80% of the time the mental health problem preceded the substance abuse problem, and that was particularly true for adolescents. So what that suggests is that a child already is in some state of depression or some state of distress, anxiety, and that the substance abuse is an attempt to kind of self-medicate or relieve feelings of stress, anxiety, and depression. Now, that's certainly not true for every child who uses substances. And it may, in fact, be more true if the child has, like, a mood disorder, like depression or anxiety. Children, for example, that have other kinds of behavioral problems, like, for example, attention deficit hyperactivity, ADHD, or a conduct disorder, sometimes you will see the substance abuse that sort of precedes some of the other symptoms in those kids. So it's hard to say which sort of leads to which, but clearly there's a group of kids that we know are taking substances just to make themselves feel relief from the emotional pain that they're feeling.
And are we, in a sense, leaving the responsibility for dealing with that to law enforcement?
Well, you know, it's unfortunate. I'll speaking again as a mental health professional here. It's unfortunate in a way that the way we have primarily designed to deal with substance use and abuse among our citizens is through the law enforcement mechanism. Because, again, there are many people that I think could be helped earlier, certainly many youth that could be identified and helped earlier, but we have not put into place good methods for identifying those kids and helping those kids, you know, school-based programs and that sort of thing. So many times those kids do not get identified as having a problem until the point of arrest. As a matter of fact, the National Mental Health Association did a study last year in 11 different states to find out at what point kids got identified and screened for mental health problems. And we found that many, many kids did not get screened or identified or even referred to treatment until they had already come to the attention of law enforcement or in many cases even been detained, like in a detention center. So to us that says that communities lack the kind of early intervention services that we need to reach out to kids and families earlier.
It's interesting that in all of the conversations I've had with law enforcement officials, when asked what they would do if they had unlimited resources, prevention seems to be the number one issue.
Well, that's also what we found. We did interviews in these 11 states with a number of people in the juvenile justice system and said, you know, what do you need? What's missing? And over and over and over again, we heard prevention, prevention, prevention. We have kids in our system that do not belong here. And I think many people in law enforcement, certainly in juvenile corrections and in adult corrections, will tell you that their systems are full of people that have untreated mental health problems and substance abuse problems. And I think that is to the shame of those agencies and systems that are to deal with those people, those children and those adults. One of the things we've seen in the juvenile, in the case of juvenile justice, is some reluctance on the part of the mental health systems in a lot of communities to deal with those kids. Children get defined early on because of their behavior as having a conduct disorder and not really a mental health disorder. Or as not being appropriate for certain kinds of mental health treatment. And so to some extent, the professionals have turned their back on a group of kids. And those are the kids that tend to end up in the juvenile justice system. They're kids who have conduct problems, attention deficit many times, behavioral problems. They're children of color. Children with poor family resources and that sort of thing. And those are, again, if you look in the justice system, those are the kids you see there.
If we are to place blame, though, is the blame on the system or is the blame on society, which in many ways tolerates substance abuse?
Well, we send very mixed messages, I think, to children about substance use. And in the area of alcohol and tobacco in particular, kids get different kinds of messages from parents and adults than they do about illicit drugs. I do think also that we need to take, the society in general needs to take some of the blame for the criminalization of kids with problems. You know, in particular, the rhetoric that has been so rampant the last, 5 to 8 years about juvenile crime and getting tough on kids and holding kids accountable, that is, those are strong words that play well politically. The result of that kind of political rhetoric and firing up that kind of emotion in citizens is that more and more children are being incarcerated, even though the juvenile crime rates are not going up. I don't know what they're doing in North Dakota in this area, but around the country they've been dropping for the last 6 or 7 years. Unfortunately, the incarceration rates are not dropping, even though the crime rate is dropping. We are locking up more kids. We're sweeping more kids into the correction system. And many of the children that we're sweeping in are children with behavioral problems and mental health problems. So I think that punitive attitude, that attitude of no tolerance, zero tolerance, that gets espoused a lot, has not served children well. I think what it has done is move a lot of children that have problems, emotional, behavioral, substance abuse problems, into the criminal justice system where they do not get identified or treated.
Do we have any idea what the long-term ramifications of that are?
Well, some of the, I mean, we have some. Kids with mental health problems in particular are at high risk in juvenile justice settings, just as adults with mental health problems are at high risk in justice-type settings. They tend to be the kids that get in trouble behaviorally inside justice settings. They tend to spend longer time locked up, more time in isolation, more time in restraints. So there are some clear risks every time we lock up a kid whose primary problems are emotional behavioral problems. I think the long-term outcomes are that those kids tend to be ones that also end up then in the adult system. I mean, we feed children directly out of our juvenile justice system into the adult system. And if you have listen to some of the data that's come out recently from the federal government in Washington, you know, huge numbers of people in our adult jails and prisons are people also that have mental health problems. So we have not done ourselves any favor. I know once you start a child in the criminal system and treat the child in a way that criminalizes the child's behavior and so forth, that's the system they tend to stay in as they move into adulthood. So,
is intervention and prevention prohibitively expensive? Is it something society could not afford to do?
I don't think it's prohibitively expensive. I think it's more a matter of political will than it is money. Some of the most effective interventions, particularly for kids, we know are not that expensive. I mean, for years we used to put everybody in hospitals, and that was very expensive. But those days are clearly over for a number of different reasons. But some of the most effective interventions for kids, even kids in the justice system, there is good research. The most effective interventions are home-based, family-based, school-based, community-based intervention with families. They are not putting kids in institutions. They are not putting kids in residential facilities necessarily. As a matter of fact, a lot of the research doesn't show very, very good effects for kids from that type of treatment. But the best, so some of the best types of treatment for kids with problems are not as expensive nearly as residential care or hospitalization or even as incarceration 24 hours a day.